Talk given Friday, 2nd January, 1976. Those of us who are seriously concerned with the living of the religious life, which means the truly human life, are faced always with several problems. First and foremost, what is the meaning of the religious life? What is it for? Is it because we are aiming at a particular goal? If we are, that is a mistake. There is no particular goal to be achieved or attained by us as separate individuals. But there is the realization of complete religiousness, which means complete humanness, if one lives the religious life. It is mankind which reaps the fruit of our having lived religiously. There is nothing whatsoever for me, the person. Incidentally, peace, vision, understanding, the experiencing, the continual experiencing of communion with totality, all that comes to the individual. But if he pursues it as a desirable goal for himself, then he is defeated right from the start. One lives the religious life because that is the human life. When that sort of life has flowered into a life which is lived perfectly spontaneously and naturally, then there is no pursuing of a goal for oneself. And this separate self, this separate self-consciousness, which desires to grasp at particular finite and therefore mortal things for oneself, that separate selfness completely goes. And then at last one is truly human. One is unselfish, to use the common word, without striving to be unselfish. What has happened is that one's mode of awareness of oneself, the environment, of all existence, and the whole life process has undergone a complete transformation. And because of this transformation, a new dimension of being and consciousness has come to fruition. And then each individual person, a true individual, has gone past all egoism, but has realized perfect egohood. Now, one can begin to sense the difference between this condition and the ordinary human condition, which is self-centered, continuously tries to draw the world unto itself. And because of the abysmal ignorance of each and every one of us on this globe, because of that abysmal ignorance, we try to draw the wrong things to ourselves. They are invariably wrong because we have not the vision of the transcendent reality as a natural, spontaneous, completely clear vision, free of all the limitations imposed by our natural heritage of greed and fear and ambition and so on through evolution, and our socio-cultural heritage with all its imposed values and moralities and so forth. Not for a moment that the values and moralities are wrong. They are absolutely right. But when one fulfills them naturally and spontaneously, not as an ought to be, but as a matter of course, it is a matter of course that one doesn't shoot one's neighbor or the next person because one doesn't like the look of him. One is just naturally, spontaneously, totally understanding, loving, truthful, and so forth. So those moralities are an indispensable basis for the living of the religious life. Let us have no illusions whatsoever about that. Again, our ideals, as we call them, we no longer cling to our intellectually thought out ideals, our intellectually thought out ought to be's. Isn't it an extraordinary conceit on my part if I were to say, imperfect person, ignorant person that I actually am, that this is what ought to be. This is the perfect and the right thing, and so it shall be. Is my little vision, is my little intellectual perception the whole of understanding, the whole of wisdom? If my mind is cluttered with my particular ideas and so forth, I am denying the fact that that transcendent totality which is mind needs to function through me unresistingly. If I resist with imposing my particular conceptions upon totality, then mind in its reality cannot function through me. It is always a distortion of the thing. Just as this body, the physical body, is a material manifestation, a finite manifestation of the total materiality of the universe. It's a particular and finite thing. And if it is not in harmony with the simple laws of nature which govern the process of this totality, this material totality, the body is ill. It's not that case. And it's the same with what we call the psyche or the mind. If this psyche, which I call my psyche or my mind, wants to impose its particular desires and fancies and whims and appetites and so forth upon the totality which is mind, this mind is an ill mind. But we never really see these things. We are so conscious in terms of ourselves as separate individuals, existing as separate individuals, with some relationships with others, as we call them, and with the environment. And because we do not understand at all, we haven't begun to understand the meaning of this complete relationship with the totality. We are absolutely part and parcel of that totality. Because we do not understand this, therefore we are everlastingly in conflict with the environment, with the not-self, as we call it. And therefore, the psychophysical being, which is oneself, is in an ill state. It's in a state of misery. If, for instance, I were to take to the orthodox teachings of the religions and say, ah, I've got the truth, it is there, it's the word of God. Granted, it is the word of God. Let us not argue about that for the moment. Granted, it is the word of God. But what extraordinary conceit on my part to believe that I, a simple, frail mortal, simple not in the sense of simplicity, but in the sense of being a simpleton, am capable of understanding the real meaning, the whole meaning of the word of God. You see, we never think about these things. We never look into them deeply enough. We are so self-preoccupied that the truth and the beauty, the marvel, and everything that is around us actually present is missed by us. We blind ourselves, we deafen ourselves. We make ourselves incapable. We bind ourselves. So you see, these are problems which arise in connection with realizing what is meant by true human living. Now I said a few moments ago, that we blind ourselves and deafen ourselves. Looking, listening, touching, the use of all our senses, the use of the brain as an instrument for a clear thinking process. All these senses are not well used. They are ill used. When we look, for example, do we look and only look? Or do we look for something which we have desired? Take the very interesting case of an intellectual who picks up a new book and he says, well, let's see what's there in this. Now when he says, well, let's see what there is in this, he has his own ideas of what he wants to see in the book. And so, he never really reads the book. His mind isn't open. It is already hemmed in on all sides. And he picks out the things which he likes and very graciously condescends to approve of it. And he picks out all the things which he considers wrong or incorrect, etc. And of course, slates the book. Perhaps he's a critic or a reviewer. He has to earn his living, so he must dip his pen in the ink and write according to this subhuman functioning of the mind. He never really reads. So, do I really look when I'm looking? Do I really listen when I'm listening? This is a point of fundamental importance. You have heard me say time and again, the senses are, in their perfection, in their perfect, activity, the living cords of communion. All the senses in operation are actually the living cords of communion. Now, just consider this for a few moments with me. When man has flowered out into true manhood, he is truly the son of man, the son of mind, the mind which is completely cleansed of all evil, mind you. See? When he is in that state, he is in the state of communion continuously, which implies fundamentally that he is no longer separatively, isolatively self-conscious. He is, of course, self-conscious in the sense that he is well aware that there is what we call himself, a psychophysical organism. But he is at the same time fully sensitive to his relationships with everything around him. Persons, things, events, situations, ideas, and so on. He is in complete relationship with them. Now, if and when he is in complete relationship with them, there is no conflict whatever. There will be a passing flux of pleasure-pain involved. Of course. But there will be no conflict. There will be such complete attentiveness, and this is the key point of the whole thing. There will be such complete attentiveness that he will not, of his own volition, of his own desire, accept something out of preferential choice and reject other things out of preferential choice. He will be so totally attentive that there is no consciousness at all that I, John Brown, am looking at that person or that thing, or I, John Brown, am dealing with that situation. That person, that thing, that situation being something other than me. This is our supreme trouble. Our awareness is in terms of otherness, not in terms of unity. A unity in which is integrated the innumerable particulars which compose that unity. Particulars all in relationship to each other. When the sense of an isolative sense of otherness functions in us, then we are in disharmony within ourselves. Our minds, our whole being is fragmented and functions fragmentarily instead of as a whole. So, we can now ask this other question, this other problem which comes up, and it is always worded wrongly. Well, what is the method to achieve this? You have a method to achieve that which is other than yourself. There is everlastingly the otherness of the thing which you have achieved. You are a mountaineer. You have climbed to the top of Everest. The top of Everest is always a something other than yourself. In actual physical fact, it will everlastingly be so, as long as you live. But the mind and consciousness, which is operating in this person who is climbing Everest, preserves that otherness in the wrong way. And therefore, there is a conflict. The climbing of Everest has become an achievement which is a conquest of Everest. And man uses the word conquest in all these contexts. Where does conquest take place and under what circumstances? Of battle, of conflict, of hate, of enmity. Not of wisdom, not of love, of humanity, of harmony. So, the moment we ask, what is the method to achieve this? At the back of the mind, deep down in our psyche, is this awareness of self as something separate from the rest of the world, and it wants to achieve something which is a conquest over something else. Even the scriptures of the world, every one of them has made this peculiar verbal mistake. I'm being kind and saying it's a verbal mistake, but it is a little bit deeper than that. Of saying, overcome the evil. Fight against the evil. Neither you nor I can overcome or fight against the evil, excepting at the cost of our lives. And this is something which is very difficult to understand. This attempting to overcome evil means that what I call evil is rejected by me. If I start with rejection, supposing you and I have a difference, have a problem between us, we are in trouble with each other. Supposing I start off with this attitude of rejection, how can there ever be a true considering together and arriving at what is commonly called a solution? If we do not reject each other, if that sense of otherness if one's particular desires and objectives are all put aside, and we get together and really look and understand, then there emerges something which is the fruition of both wisdom and love in harmony. Then that, I'll use the worldly phrase, will be of lasting benefit. That will spell true happiness. And true happiness is something which is quite outside this petty little realm of pleasant sensation, of mere satisfaction emotionally or intellectually. But you will have true happiness then. You will just be happiness itself. Don't have to seek it. You don't have to seek the solution of the problem. It just emerges. Why? How? Because it is part of the living, growing process. It's a live thing. You can't seek life. You can't catch hold of it. Can you show me life in a test tube? Or on a dinner plate? Or in a room? Or in a box? In the air? Or in the sea? Or anywhere? Can you show me life? What is this mysterious thing, life? We are living creatures. We know a great deal about the chemical, physical mechanism of a live body and so forth and so forth. But we don't know this mystery which is life. And the mystery is something which everlastingly emerges and comes to fruition when I am not desiring it, when I am not looking for it, and afterwards when I become aware, this has come off very nicely. This is all right. Or it may not have come off very nicely, and yet it is perfectly all right. Both ways it is right. It is truth. It transcends the pairs of opposites. So now, a method. Don't look for a method. The reality of method, let me use the same word in this context, the reality of method is the actual living process. And this living process involves what? Attention. The manner in which I attend to everything. When I am looking, I don't see what I am looking at unless I am attending to what I am looking at. If my attention is directed towards what I am looking, then I know what I am looking at. But if I am absolutely, say, lost in thought or seized with some overpowering emotion or fear or something, then although I am looking, I am not seeing. Isn't that the fact? And it's the same with listening. But if I attend, then there is a relationship set up straight away. The operation of the sense of sight or hearing, etc., is a cord of communication at this stage. Now, if as I am attending, I attend absolutely purely, without any desire involved, without any reactions from me involved, approval, disapproval, wanting to grasp, wanting to gain something, wanting to do something, enjoy something, run away from something, without any reactions whatsoever, then there is pure attention. You know what you will actually realize if you attend like that? You will realize the true meaning of omniscience, amongst other things. It doesn't mean that you are or become a know-all, not the least bit. Omniscience, in its true sense, functions in the deeps of mind, where what you and I commonly call the conscious mind and the unconscious mind are utterly unified, completely integrated into one whole, and we have transcended any conflict. Then that is the omniscient state. Don't you see what sort of a state that is? It is a state of complete communion, a state in which love in its reality is actually functioning. And this is due to the kind of attentiveness, this intensity of attentiveness, where separate selfness, the awareness of separate selfness, with all its attendant desires and fears and ambitions and passions and all the rest of it, is completely out. This is the meaning of being a man, a happy creator, a human being, a happy creator. So, your method. Attend. Attend completely and purely. There are many wonderful things which emerge out of this. You know, for one thing, you know how in Buddhist teaching, the discipline of the senses is described in this fashion. When you see a person or a thing, you are not entranced with the general appearance or with the particulars. You are not prone to attachment. You are free from aversion. You just see the whole person, the whole fact, the whole situation as it is, to the extent that you are capable of seeing. Your mind is not reacting helplessly, because all helpless reaction is born of one's own greed, fear, hate, illusions and delusions. So, if one functions that way, what greed, hate, fear and so on that is actually present in us already becomes cleansed. We don't get rid of them, because these are psychical energies. They constitute our psyche. This energy which functions as greed or hate or whatever it is a particular functioning of our own living psychical energy. And that ill mode of functioning is transformed into the healthy, well mode of functioning, which is in terms of understanding of love, which we mustn't try to define, because this love, this wisdom completely transcends our common definitions. So for one thing, that is, we see what is meant by teaching of that sort. You find in Zarathustrianism the whole thing embodied in three phrases: good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Humatha, hukta, hu-ukta. Ukta is the word, you see. Hu means the happy, the good, the healthy, the well. Hukta, hu-vrashta. Humatha, hukta, hu-vrashta. Good thought, good word, good deed. And you find that this sort of ethic, instead of being confined to the realm of relativity, where you function ambivalently, you know, the usual love, hate, kindness, cruelty, ambivalence which goes on, you're quite free of all that. This ethic then functions no longer as a relative ethic, but as a transcendental ethic. It is beyond good and evil in our sense of the term good and evil. It is the absolute good. Now please realize that this does not mean that one can, after that sort of intellectual clarification, say to oneself, oh, I've seen the truth, I can do what I like. I cannot do what I like. Because the moment I try to do what I like, I am out of the transcendental state, back into the common, to use Jesus's words, swinish and viperous state of conflict and subhuman evil. You know how in the New Testament, he that looketh after a woman, or if it's the case of a woman, she that looketh after a man with lust in his or her heart hath already committed adultery. And this teaching you'll find throughout all the great religions. Go way back into the Shandilya Upanishad, which presents the moralities as such, and ad nauseam the repetition takes place. Such and such a virtue in thought and word and action. Such and such in thought and word and action. You see the significance, the implication of that. We are thinking, feeling, talking, doing creatures, aren't we? That means with our whole being, we are that which we call a virtue. With our total being, there is no fragmentariness in that virtue. Holy living on Sundays, a little bit of business-like worldly living Monday to Saturday. Nothing of that sort of nonsense. There is no fragmentariness. It is total, it is complete. Is happiness, is health, real happiness or health, unless it is total and complete? Do I ever say, I'm absolutely fine, very, very healthy, but I've got a ghastly headache. That's not being healthy, is it? It's the wholeness, the holiness, which is introduced. Note very carefully the essential points then in this business of religious living. Complete attentiveness, which affects the transformation of all the ill in one's mind. And that inevitably affects bodily health too. Don't run away with the idea that the one who does live the holy life therefore will never have a bellyache or cancer or whatever it is. He will. And in any case, the body will die, will perish. Be very, very sensible about these things. It is also true that if one lives completely attentively like that, there is an actual transformation of the quality of the cells which make up your body. This phenomenon which in the religions, you find it in Christianity, you find it in Zarathustrianism, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, you find this business of the transfiguration. It is a reality. But it is a reality that happens. It is a manifestation of the grace of the universal process. It is not something you and I can seek. You and I might just as well might try to seek equality with the Almighty. And all that will happen is that we'll be kicked downstairs where it is very, very hot. Never attempt to storm the ramparts of heaven. You will know the real meaning of hellfire if you do attempt it. It happens naturally, spontaneously. So this complete attentiveness, which implies complete attentiveness through the senses, how else can you be attentive? If the senses weren't there, you couldn't attend. And the senses in this context includes, as the sixth sense, the discursive mind process. The brain is constantly talking inside, silently. It goes on talking, constantly chattering. Attend to that chatter. Don't say, I want to realize the transcendent silence and I'm going to blank my mind. Most people's minds are blank. Don't worry about that. Blank in the sense that they are non-compass. And when you get these little textbooks which says, blank the mind for 10 seconds, then concentrate upon this and then upon that, they are talking through their hats. They are unconsciously exploiters and knaves who write that sort of thing. The carrot, you know, to lure the donkey on. And in this case, it's not a good donkey, but a silly ass that is lured on. Be very, very careful, be very, very sensible about these things. So, the senses and the importance of the senses. When you attend in that manner and are perfectly mindful of the fact that in the attempt to attend, you lose your mindfulness. You are unaware of all the little reactions that go on subconsciously. You are unaware of the fact that after the effort, and you have to relax from the effort because you can't straight away sit down to a piano and give a tip-top two-hour recital. It's years of practice and development. So you get tired. And when you relax, there comes the reaction. That reaction comes from out of the so many thousand million cells that make up the whole body, and those, that enormous number of cells of the body, each one has a mind of its own, and it has its own subdivisions of conscious and subconscious. And the whole host comes up and you react, and you go down. If you find yourself disappointed, then it means that you are seeking for yourself. Don't care in the wrong way. Care in the right way. One does one's best, and one completely gives in, having done one's best, when one is tired, one is exhausted. Give in, don't resist it. That's one of the several meanings of resist not evil, which you find in the Bible. Observe it. This you can do. It is as if someone who hates you is thrusting a knife into your body all the time. I'm deliberately using the word body. We know that the body will die if that is done. But in this case, this thing which thrusts the knife into me in the reaction process does not kill the body. Now transfer that to the mind, to the psyche. The psyche is unkillable, indestructible, as long as you are alive. After that, it disappears. Whilst you are alive, the psyche is absolutely indestructible. It can be transformed. It can be changed. And if you live spontaneously, naturally, religiously, that change takes place in the healthy manner, unspoiled by personal desire, ambition, and all our shortcomings intellectually and morally. Would you call that a method? Would you call the life process within the living body a method, a technique? It is just this wonderful, mysterious life process. My task is not to resist it, but to understand it and work with it, to swim with the tide of life abundant, of life in its reality, not what is miscalled life. Nightclubs and dancing till 5 o'clock in the morning and this, that and the other and all the rest of the bestial rubbish that has cursed humanity for thousands of years. None of that. Just see it, yes. This is what is happening. And just observe what happens. 2 bottles of whiskey a day, cirrhosis of the liver. That's what happens. Fruit juices and plain, wholesome, good food, well enjoyed, no excess, good health. That's what happens. Observe it. It is as simple as that, and it is as difficult as that. You know very well, invited to dinner, oh, this, that and the other comes out. And for the sake of not offending the host, you indulge in it. Just observe. Attend. And attend completely. Because if you attend completely, when you are taking that extra whiskey which you normally never take in your life in any case, because you are a teetotaler, you see, just attend to what is actually happening. And in that pure attention, there will be no reaction, no reservations, there will be no criticism of your host, there will be no sense of superiority, I am a teetotaler and he is a person who indulges in alcohol. All that will be out. You see what I'm trying to get at? This total attentiveness is of such an extraordinary nature that it takes in the whole universe into yourself. You don't take just a part of the world, a part of mankind into yourself and reject the rest. You are in complete and full relationship with totality. You are in communion. And that is the fullness of religious living.